This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. On today's show, a great mix of experts with some really practical advice. You might think that only those who are doing advertising pitches or debating need to have good communication skills. Well, you'd be wrong. Regardless of your job or industry, it can really boost your chances of promotion. So we brought in the experts talking about how to boost your skills and where they can take you, addressing life insurance and a shocking statistic on just how few people in the UAE are ticking this bit of paperwork off their list. We were hearing from two people who have very personal stories to share about the impact it has on their life. We've discussed quiet quitting in the past, but what about quiet firing? It is apparently happening, but what does it mean and what could you do about it? And in our legal clinic with Ludmila Yamalova, we were asking her, what can you do if you see unsafe driving on the roads of the UAE? And what happens if you've lent someone money but can't pay it back?
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Today we are talking about life insurance as a necessity. I am a terrible procrastinator on this, so we're bringing in the experts. So do you have it? If not, what are some of your reasons? Because, you know, before renewing our car registration, you get your motor insurance. Before renewing our visas, you get your medical insurance. So as we always say, these are the things you hope you don't have to use. So why are there still people who are getting insurance for their cars but not their lives? And also discussing critical illness cover as well. So discuss this and more. Joining us in the studio is Anil Sharma. He is the Senior Executive Consultant at Nexus Insurance Brokers. We're also going to be joined later by two ladies, a cancer patient who had critical illness cover and was able to claim funds, and a cancer survivor who needed to use her life savings for treatment. Anil, thank you for being with us today, and we're taking questions as well. Can you give us an idea of just how many people here in the UAE are covered or are not covered with life insurance and critical illness? What's the numbers say?
Good afternoon, Helen. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Pleasure.
If you're talking about statistics, the recent study that we have is from 2020. It's just 0.8% of UAE population has life insurance.
Hang on a sec, 0.8%?
Yes, not even 1% in 100 has life insurance.
Really? I don't know what I was expecting there, but it wasn't that. What about, I mean, obviously you are, you know, an industry insider on this. Were you shocked at that?
Yes, I was shocked because 2020 statistics was released quite late because of the pandemic. But yes, it is true and it's shocking.
Oh my goodness, I really am. I mean, I had to get life insurance when I bought a property and I've just kept that going. I'm not sure I would have done if that hadn't been required because of my mortgage, you know, back then. But what are some of the, guess, the common obstacles, challenges or attitudes that might be stopping people from getting the insurance that they perhaps should?
The answer is very simple. In most of the cases, it's your family upbringing. So if your parents had life insurance, from your childhood, you have seen your parents depending on their insurance policies. It's naturally inculcated in your culture. It becomes part of your life. Mm-hmm. As soon as you start working, there's the first thing that you look is, I should have insurance for me. When you have your first child or you get married, you want to enhance your cover. So it's just runs in the family in most of the cases.
So it becomes kind of part of the financial literacy and education in a family.
Absolutely.
I think, and I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of lots of people listening today, is that it's also an expense. And, you know, when you think about cost of living, sometimes it'd be quite hard to justify something that feels quite abstract and feels like that's a problem for me in the future. And the guests we're going to be speaking to this afternoon are very much bringing to life the fact that that's not the case, I would imagine. A question here from you, Anil, that's come in saying, can you get critical illness insurance if you've had a critical illness before? No name on this message, but asking, I had cancer 5 years ago, and one of the worst aspects was worrying about money when I was off work. Can I get critical illness insurance to give me peace of mind, for example, if I had a heart attack or a completely different type of cancer?
Yeah, the answer is yes and no. You yourself answered in the second part of your question. If it's totally unrelated condition, so somebody who had a heart attack 2 years ago, he can still apply for critical illness if it is for cancer. The company can offer him a cancer-only critical illness cover. So it is possible, but very, very rarely for the same condition, almost I can say no.
And okay, right. This is the importance of the education piece, I think, is having these conversations that we might not really want to have, but we need to have the answers in order to make informed decisions about our priorities, looking after our families' finances as well. So aside from critical illness cover, what else can be included in life insurance as a kind of a package, as an offering?
Right. So the whole concept of life insurance or critical illness revolves around the primary need for a continued income in a person's life. So anything that can substitute our income makes sense to have it in your policy. Something like a disability benefit, hospitalization benefit, a long-term care benefit. Mm-hmm. All these are directly or indirectly related to your capacity to earn and provide to your family.
A message here from Nameen saying, is income protection available here?
Not in entirety. So parts of income protection is available. Like you can have a permanent total disability cover, which can give you either a lump sum or income for 12 months or 24 months. But the ones you will get in the Western part of the world, you know, it's not complete, but we are getting there.
If you do have any questions, Neil Sharma is with us this afternoon. We've stolen him away from Nexus Insurance Brokers until 3 o'clock. We are going to be speaking to a couple of people who have unfortunately had to pay particular attention to policies because of illnesses, but they're here to humanise the story about exactly what we're talking about. Just 0.8% of people in the UAE have life insurance cover. Are you one of them? Let us know your reasons. And equally, if you've got any questions, need some clarity, please do reach out. Very much here to help. And you can be anonymous if you prefer.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us this afternoon, and fantastic to be joined by our next guest. Swati is undergoing right now treatment for breast cancer and is sharing her story about, well, I guess, Swati, what you put in place before you got your diagnosis and how ultimately it's helping you now in the form of life insurance with critical illness cover. And we've spoken about this topic on the show before, but I think it's so valuable to hear from somebody that is really putting a story and some humanity to the numbers, or something that I know is on an awful lot of people's to-do lists. So thank you for joining us today. Can you tell us a little bit about, well, I guess, first of all, when you took that decision to take on the coverage and ultimately when you got your diagnosis?
Yeah. Hi, Helen. Thank you for having me on the show. It is a pleasure connecting with you and everyone here. And I'm happy to share my experience so that it could actually have a positive impact on at least some of the listeners. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, coming to your question, we had a life insurance. We had a life insurance and have been dealing with Nexus for quite some time. And so when Anil came in and said that we should add a critical illness on top of our life insurance, I was like, oh, my God, not another premium again. Already we are paying so much, right?
I know. And you kind of go, well, do we need it? I mean, is this going to be something that's going to happen to someone else? Surely not us.
Yeah, I'm healthy. I'm not smoking. I'm not drinking. I'm going to my gym. I'm walking and all. And I'm totally healthy. Why do I need another coverage? Mm-hmm. And Anil said, just hear me out. Let me tell you the benefits. And I said, okay, fine, sure. So my husband and I, we heard him out. It made some sense. While I was not totally bought in at that time, but my husband felt the need for it. Mm-hmm. And he said that this is something that we should invest in. It is for our own good. And it's not for just for today. It is for our old age. And that is how we took it.
That's an interesting point.
If something happens to us when we are 60, 65, it will help us. Mm-hmm. And that is how we took that decision. And believe me, today when I look back, that was a blessing in disguise for sure.
Oh, well, I mean, it's one of these things that you hope you're never going to have to use. And, you know, as I said, you are currently undergoing treatment for breast cancer. So when did you get that diagnosis? Can you tell us a little bit more about how you are doing?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with breast cancer in Feb of 2020, okay. Towards the Feb end. So numerous tests, PET scan and everything, and within 2 weeks I came to know that, okay, I had the cancer and the lump was malignant. And yes, the world was battling with COVID at that time, and I started fighting my own battle. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So it was, you know, those are tense days, and it was really very stressful. But the moment we told Anil about it, he arranged for the funds within 10 days. So we were able to get the claim out of the critical illness within 10 days. And I can't emphasize the peace of mind that we got that, okay, this my treatment is not going to be impacted by lack of fund. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if there are tests that are not included in the insurance, I will still be able to fund it for myself. Also, I have always been working. So just thinking that, oh, you might be out of work for some time while you're doing for the treatment, this fund helped me take that decision as well. And thanks to God, everything went smoothly. I was able to get my surgery done. And things are back in place. I'm on my toes again, running around. And this has definitely helped me a lot, yeah.
I think what I'm taking away from speaking to you, Swati, is that peace of mind that in the midst of COVID chaos and confusion and, you know, no doubt very serious discussions with doctors, that you didn't have to worry about something else. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It brings a lot of financial freedom to you, yeah? The peace of mind. You don't want to eat up your savings for yourself, right? You always think, at least personally, you start thinking, oh no, our family savings should not be used up so much on me. And believe me, cancer treatment is not easy. And especially if you want to do some of the tests which help you do a gene test to find out whether it is genetic or not, or whether you want to, should you go for chemo or not. So there is an oncotype test for which the blood samples have to be sent to US, and all these tests are quite expensive.
I'm sure.
And not covered by most of the insurances.
And
the medical insurance.
So can I ask what's happened with work then? Are you taking a break from work? Have you decided to stop working? What kind of impact has it had on that income stream, I suppose?
Yeah, so initially, yes, I had to take all my sick leave and everything. Mm-hmm. But because of COVID, bare COVID was a boon for me. Since we were working from home, I did not need to take a long sabbatical. Mm-hmm. So otherwise, yes, at least if I would have to go out and would be meeting people, and then since the immunity levels would be low, I would need to take break. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, I did not need to do that. But yes, that thought was there, that if my health is not permitting me to work, then I could actually take the leave for some time.
Oh my goodness. And how are you feeling now? What stage are you at with that treatment, Swati?
So currently, so it's been, 2.5 years, mm-hmm. and I am currently cancer-free, so it is absolutely fine. Everything is on track. The therapy is going to go, the hormone therapy will go on for another 5 to 7 years. This is a long battle. And the fear of relapse is always there. But yeah, I'm taking it positively. I'm fighting it out. And I'm sure I'll be fine.
That's really encouraging to hear. It really is. And we've spoken in the past about even life insurance. And, you know, I'm a terrible one for procrastination. I really am. I think adults kind of split into two camps. There's really the proactive type who don't want to bury their hand in the sand. And then there's me who's going, well, you know, surely my dad would come along and sort that out, even though I'm married and 40 years old. You know, we kind of think there's going to be some, you know, knight on a horse that is going to protect us from the inevitabilities of life or, you know, unfortunate things happening. And I think I'm just starting to realise that, you know, I'm the one that needs to make some of these things happen now as a parent and a fully almost functioning member of society. And, you know, whether it is, in your case, that critical illness cover that's allowed you financial freedom and peace of mind to have the, you know, the positivity and the time needed to undergo your treatment, or, my God, you know, should the worst happen, if you have life insurance, that you're not trying to deal with paperwork in the depths of grief. I think, you know, there's a huge amount of power in taking that control, in taking that power and getting ahead of anything happening. What message would you give to anyone who perhaps is like me and has something like this on their to-do list and is just hoping that some of the realities of being an adult in the modern world are just not going to apply?
Start this early in your life. So the earlier you start one of these insurances, the life insurance plus the critical cover today, it will actually, the premium will not be as high as you, and you will be able to afford it. But in the long run, if, God forbid, you need to use it, you will have an option. And the medical insurance will definitely help people in the long run, for sure. When you take insurances, you don't want it to be used, right? But in the worst case scenario, they will definitely help. And the earlier a person takes an insurance, the lesser the premium is, So it definitely helps folks.
Well, Swati, everyone here is wishing you all the very best. It's wonderful to hear you're cancer-free. It's a really important message. That's what it comes down to. So all the very best to you and your family. Keep fighting the good fight. And thank you, as I said, for letting us hear the humanity behind something that we know we should all do. But now I think really understanding the importance of that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We just heard that from Swati, who has benefited from her critical illness cover on her life insurance, and delighted to be welcomed to the studio now, Perla Nunez, another brave cancer survivor, to tell her story about what she went through, the paperwork involved and that diagnosis. And Perla, I'm so grateful you're here. Thank you so much. You've known just how important life insurance is from an early age. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, that's right. I am aware of how important it is with the life insurance and, of course, the medical insurance, because from my family, we already have a history of chronic illness. My sister, who was diagnosed also with cancer, unfortunately, she passed away, but she did have a very good insurance package. So at that time, when she was undergoing the treatment, everything was paid for in terms of insurances. And of course, after she died, she was able to leave some, she got a good amount of money for her 7-year-old daughter at that time. So I knew the importance of it.
So there is, unfortunately, as you say, a cancer history in the family. Now, and you had life insurance and temporarily suspended it when you went to New Zealand. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what happened during that window?
Yes, that's right. I have been in New Zealand for the last 5 years, and at that time I was working, and after like last year I decided to study. So I took up a postgraduate study, and at that time I wasn't working. So I had to choose between how am I going to manage paying for my insurance and my rent. Mm-hmm. So I knew that it was still very important. So before I had to suspend my insurance, I did all the works. I had my mammogram.
Good girl. Yeah.
I did my scans, my pap smear, everything that is required in terms of protection of the chronic illness. So I thought I was good. And then after 2 months, when I was studying, I was diagnosed of breast cancer, stage 2. Even though I got my insurance suspended, I also had another insurance. It was a student insurance for the students. So it did a lot for me as well during that time, because it paid off a lot of my scans, everything, the tests that I had, PET scans. So I didn't really let go of the insurance alone, but I had some assistance on that.
Can I ask how you are now?
Oh, by the grace of God, I'm like cancer survivor for 2 months.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, just 2 months.
Oh, how wonderful. What a feeling that must have been to have that.
Yes, it's a great relief.
Oh, I'm so, so thrilled for you. I really am. And as I said to Swati, you know, when you've had a scary diagnosis and you're trying to plan and think about how a family's going to feel about money, should be the last thing on your mind.
But exactly.
But unfortunately, you know, it's the modern world and modern medicine, mm-hmm. and you know, things obviously cost money for good reason. So can I ask now, what have you put in place or put back in place, and how has that kind of been, I guess, on the other side of it all with insurances?
So as soon as I got diagnosed, I was told that, of course, my insurance couldn't pay for the treatment. So the first thing I did was go back to Manila to get my treatment.
Cheaper.
Yeah, it's a lot cheaper. I did have some minor insurances in Manila, so that's what paid off some of my treatment, like for my surgeries and my radiation as well. So it did help having those kind of insurances. So it pays a lot.
And then you also had the courage to speak to your financial advisor and kind of put some plans in place there. How did that go?
Yeah, so when I got back to Manila, I spoke to my insurance advisor, and she was really wonderful. She was awesome because she helped me through a lot, because, you know, if you are undergoing a lot of treatment, it's having a very good advisor that would really ease off a lot of stress also mm-hmm. during that time. So mm-hmm. she did help me with in terms of getting some reimbursement because I was able to get my insurance reinstated, which is very good.
Yeah. Yes. We're also joined in the studio now by Anil Sharma. He's a senior executive consultant at Nexus. And you said off air that Perlin is very lucky, very blessed to have things back in place. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
I've been doing this job for 26 years, and I just told her when I was sitting with her that you are the first case in 26 years I've seen that the insurance company decided to reinstate your cover, knowing that you have undergone this illness. Oh, you are so, so lucky.
I know.
Blessed in all ways, Perlin. Thank you so, so much for coming in and explaining that, you know, life happens, illness happens, and yes. to come out fighting. And now, as you say, to have that reassurance, that peace of mind that you're going to be looked after mm-hmm. now, that must be fantastic. And what would you say to anyone listening today who, a bit like me, is on, not only on the fence, but is procrastinating a little yes. bit about this?
Yeah, one thing I learned from this journey is even if, like for me, I'm single, so most of the single women would probably tend to put their expenses on something else and they will not really prioritize the health. But if you reach around 40s, that's the time that you should start thinking about chronic illness, and that's the time that you should be prepared. Like for me, I was very healthy. I never had any insurance claim in my life, and all of a sudden, boom, I got diagnosed. So
a big C.
Yes, mm-hmm. it's a big C. So, yeah, for women like me, you should always save up. You don't know life's uncertainties. It's unpredictable. You never know who, how and when it will hit you.
So take control, empower yes. yourself.
Perlin, right.
Thank you so much. And wonderful to see you in such great health. Long may
thank
it
you.
Continue. Anil, much appreciated. Thank you for your insights. And as I said, Anil Sharma is joining us from Nexus Insurance Brokers. Are you frozen when it comes to public speaking? Do you think you could ask for a raise without breaking down or running away? Well, between now and 5:30, we're helping you out with really good communication.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
You might think about, you know, doing a pitch Mad Men style, but maybe, just maybe, learning how to communicate effectively, no matter what your job role or industry, could be putting you at a real advantage. So we are talking about the importance of good communication skills this half hour, regardless of the industry. So if you've got any questions for the team, get in touch. Join me live in the studio. We've got Razlyn Razia. She is an award-winning public speaker, corporate trainer with Response Plus Holdings, and trains on communication, specifically in the medical industry. But you'd be happy to take any questions today.
Of course I will be.
I had no qualms about putting you behind a microphone and just aww. Starting you off, which is great.
Can I just say that I'm nervous now?
Do you know what's funny? Is I'm obviously on the radio every afternoon. Public speaking makes me want to vomit.
Really?
Yeah. I really, really don't enjoy it. The only way I've kind of tipped it over, so kind of pre-COVID I was, I don't think I've ever talked about this on the radio before. I perform wedding blessings and ceremonies and do baby naming ceremonies. And that's what the only reason, through the practice of doing something that's so lovely with lovely people, has kind of helped boost my confidence. But the thought of standing up and pitching or debating, I'd be in the toilet,
okay,
nauseous.
So what you've just said, right, how you actually got yourself over it, I never believed that there's such a thing as the fear of public speaking. I actually think, and this is purely my own opinion, I believe that there is a fear of looking silly.
Big time. It's the yes. humiliation threat.
Correct. So it's more about the human. So now that we've understood that, if we can actually move forward and say, okay, it is the fear of looking silly, then you no longer have to mitigate an inane fear. You can then start to mitigate a real fear, something that you can actually control, mm-hmm. right? So the fear of public speaking, if we repackage it and look at what makes you silly and you address that, suddenly it gives you an added level of confidence. Now, I'm not mm-hmm. saying that suddenly if you just acknowledge that it's a fear of being silly and wow,
you're going to do a TED talk.
Exactly. You know, yeah. you're not going to be out there and going, wow, I can do this for the next 15 minutes. No.
But it feels less abstract and more in your control.
Correct. The moment you have more control, you tend to be able to build your confidence. Mm-hmm. So how you actually build that is, I believe that you do a lot of preparation. So if you're like coming here, for example, I did my preparation. I was thinking about, okay, what exactly do I want to say? How do I want to present it? I have talking points in my head, right? And I made sure that when I talk about my experience, I will talk about something that I am very certain about. Mm-hmm. So that is preparation. And then practice. You practice, well, okay, this is a radio, but you do have Facebook Live. So
we are live on Facebook.
People are looking at me right now. And I forgot to make an appointment with my plastic surgeon because I didn't know that. You should have told me
that's
earlier.
That's why I got into radio. I was like, there's never going to be any cameras in radio.
Yeah, well,
wrong.
Whoa.
They're everywhere. Yeah, plus social media. We're surrounded.
Yeah.
It's not
scary. So I know it scares the living. That scares the living lights out of me. But more importantly, back to what we're saying. Mm-hmm. So there are three P's, right? You prepare, you practice. So if you're going to deliver a public talk of some sort, you practice in front of the mirror, practice in front of your friends, practice in front of your partner, practice at the office.
If you've got a dog, practice in front
of them. Practice in front of the dog because you'd be surprised. The dog would probably give you some of the best feedback. You forget something, the box, right? And then that's pretty much it, right? Prepare, practice.
What are some of the big challenges that clients come to you with that you help them? And as I said, you work a lot with corporate training in the media, in the medical space, but really across all industries. What are some of the big worries, concerns, objections people have or barriers to good communication?
Okay, one of the, in the medical industry, if you're talking about nurses and the patient experience, for example, because in our Response Plus, we deal a lot with the medical industry. One of the biggest challenges is I'm busy because, you know, if you are in the hospital, there will be peak periods and everybody's busy during that time. It shows on my face. It shows on what I do. So how do you deal with that, right? It's all about nonverbal communications as well. You know, it's about how you smile at somebody, how you acknowledge somebody.
Especially in those environments where people are feeling frantic and confused and vulnerable and emotional.
Correct. I mean, if you're not feeling well, the last thing you want is somebody who is like staring daggers at you or
looking to your chart
and going like, whatever. So that is actually one of the biggest area that we are facing with our clients right now. But in clients who are outside of the medical industry, I think it's back to what we said earlier on, that fear of public speaking. Some of them are so knowledgeable and yet they don't know how to arrange how to actually present the knowledge.
Again, I don't think I've ever said this on the radio before, but I've had guests come in and they've got the most amazing resumes, incredible experience, and I'm really excited to speak to them. And they'll sit where you're sitting and I go, good grief, this is going to be a long half hour.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because, you know, you can have the best knowledge in the world, but if you can't impart that in a way that feels, especially, you know, in this environment, relatable and useful and inclusive, then it's tough going, let me tell you.
See, this is when having a little sort of like a scaffolding at the back of your head, this is when it helps. Mm-hmm. So every time you say something, always remember there should be a link at the beginning. So it's sort of like an introduction. And then you get to the matter of it and then you just conclude. So it's exactly what I just did. You mentioned something. And the first thing I said was I made a link to it. I said, see, this is why you need to have a scaffolding. And that was my introduction. And then I went on to explain what the scaffolding was. And then I conclude to say over to you, you can go on to the next set.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
So this is flowing beautifully.
Tell me.
Video calls. Mm-hmm. I was on one earlier and someone did it very well and someone didn't do it very well. But I was kind of curious about the mechanics behind communication in a time when we didn't know what Zooming was 3 years ago. And now we're still Zooming.
We're still using it. Mm. In fact, right now we're still going on.
So communication through screens and whether that is a job interview or a conference, is there anything we can be adjusting in our communication skills?
Definitely. The first thing you need to know when you're doing a Zoom call, locate where your video camera is. Mm-hmm. That is rule number one.
So I shouldn't be fixing my hair because I don't know.
Well, if you had your camera switched off, you could actually
I just find myself getting
fix
like,
your hair.
A little,
yes,
know.
You can do that if your camera is switched off. Okay. But the moment your camera is switched on, You need to know where your camera is and always speak to the camera. See, the biggest problem with Zoom calls is distraction. Mm. What happens is you have all the screens at the bottom of you.
And you're like, oh, what's that book behind him? Or, yeah. Oh, she's got a sweet little cat there. Or, you know, all that
okay,
stuff.
That is one. But the other one is we assume that we're talking to that person that we're talking to. Mm. But when we are talking to that person this way, we're actually away from the camera. So you are not making eye contact. Like now we're having a conversation. We're making great eye contact, thanks. Right? Because we're talking to each other. When you do not look at the camera, that's what happens. So what I always advise people to do is take a post-it, take an arrow, whatever. Make sure you highlight where your camera is. Avoid looking at the reaction of people. I know it's a bit tough. It's going to be tough. One of the ways to do it is to bring your own video box right up to underneath where the camera is so that it cheats your eye line. Mm. And then it will become far more effective because you are actually looking at the person you are communicating with over Zoom. One of the worst things to do is to be like, you know, you're looking everywhere and you're trying to convince somebody because you're like talking to him, but
you're not getting that sense of connection.
He's not getting it. He's not getting the connection because you are not looking at him.
Makes sense. Right. Lots to think about. Any questions, get in touch. Reslyn with us this afternoon. We're going to be talking next about how to get what you want at work, whether it is an interview, negotiating a salary increase. What are some of your questions, your concerns? Get in touch.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Continuing our discussions around the importance of good communication skills and focusing on now about how you can ask for what you want at work with professional development coach and an expert on confidence and communication skills. Alia Raja is with us. She's also got her own podcast called The Women Who Flourish. Now, Alia, can you teach confidence?
Hi, Helen. It's great to be here. I believe you absolutely can teach confidence for sure. So, confidence is a skill. You know, I think we can easily fall into the trap of thinking, you know, we either have confidence or we don't. It's something we're born with or we're not, but it's not. It's like any other skill. It's something we do. So the more we practice confidence, the more confident we become.
So it's like a muscle.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I always describe it like that. Like, it's like going to the gym and doing squats.
How can we build this muscle, Alia? Because I think a lot of people think about these kind of limiting beliefs or, you know, I'm not a good public speaker or I'm terrible at negotiating. And we put these barriers in place ourselves often based on our experiences. So what can we do to flex that muscle, especially in the workplace where we want to be putting our best foot forward and we want to be maximising our earning potential and being perceived well within our industry, whatever that is?
For sure. So the first step really is awareness. You know, I know there's all these confidence tips out here, like do this, do that, do this. But first of all, you know, it's different for everyone and we need to develop that awareness. So really it's about taking kind of a few moments aside and saying, what am I doing right now that's getting in the way? What are some of the behaviors? So, for example, which areas of my life do I not feel very confident in and why? What's going on for me there? So maybe in some areas you find that you're not able to speak up. Maybe in some areas of your life you keep comparing yourself to other people. Maybe there's some areas where you're judging yourself a lot. So first you've kind of got to get in, which is obviously sometimes we don't want to do that. We don't want to, it's like the ugly hard stuff.
We want to avoid that discomfort, yeah. But you've got to push through it in order to progress, to grow, or, you know, in your ways to flourish. Where do you stand on some of the most kind of common confidence tips? You know, your power poses before a presentation or breathing or, you know, watching a Denzel Washington pep talk on YouTube.
Yeah. Oh, it's great in the morning. I mean, definitely all of those. I'd say really it's a self-talk. And, you know, this is something that we have to do continuously. It's not just, okay, great. I've spoken to myself kindly now for a week, I'm more confident now. No, it's something we have to do continuously. Mm-hmm. So this is like, you know, for example, yes, first thing in the morning, I like to think of every new day as a new chapter. So every new day you have a fresh start. You get to decide, how do I want my day to be? So, you know, self-talk. And I think it's easier to be, you know, kinder to ourselves and motivating when times are good in our lives. But it's harder when, you know, times are challenging. So it's like being aware of the talk and asking myself, hey, like, is this nice what I'm saying to myself right now? Am I being kind to myself? Is this true? Is this actually a fact? And then start to question that and say, no, I'm going to tell myself something different instead.
A message here saying, Helen, I am terrified of public speaking. My voice shakes, my knees shiver. But the irony is I'm a teacher. When I'm asked to do professional development, I can't. I mean, absolute hats off to you. I think, first of all teachers are amazing. Kids are a tough crowd. If you can do that, I firmly believe you can do anything. I really do.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about workplace. You're communicating your needs to, it could be your boss, it could be HR. You know, we've got lots of discussion around remote working, flexible hours, pay increase. How can you walk into that room? You know, you've set up a meeting, you know what you want to get out of that time. How can you best use communication skills to walk out with the result that you need?
Well, first of all, I just kind of want to go back on, just touch on that point you made about knowing what you want. I think, first of all, it sounds easier than done, but you need to know what you want. You need to be specific in knowing what you want, firstly, because if you're not sure of what you want, then it's going to be quite vague. The conversation will be vague and blurred. So first of all, knowing what you want. And secondly, go in there believing that the outcome will be positive, because all of that then will be, you know, translated in your energy, in your tone, how you show up. If you, like, it's like going to an interview, a meeting.
First date,
absolutely. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I hope it's a yes. I hope they like me. I hope they give me the job. You're going to be giving off that, right? And the chances are probably that it's not going to go in your favor. But if you go in there feeling like it's positive, then you're going to be a lot more relaxed. Mm-hmm. You're going to move the conversation in a way that it will actually have more positive outcomes.
A message here, no name on it, saying, whenever I negotiate, I get frustrated. And when I get frustrated, I cry. Not very professional. Any advice? I'm like that. When I get angry, I cry. And it undermines every point I've made, even if it's an excellent one. I'm like, oh, great. There I am dissolving again. Yeah. So any tips there for, I guess, kind of emotionally steeling yourself and making sure you're being as professional as possible?
Yeah. Okay, just to kind of answer that in a nutshell, I'd say, first of all, if that's a story you're telling yourself, that's something to be mindful of.
You know, a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Like, oh, every time I get frustrated, I cry. So it's like, okay, I'm frustrated, I'm crying, that's what's going to happen. So shift that, reframe that. And instead, you know, tell yourself at the beginning of the meeting, you know what, I trust myself. Mm-hmm. It's going to be okay. You know, have a more, again, I think this is something, you know, we delve into it in our conversations, you know, just kind of summarizing in a minute, it would be around kind of questioning that belief you have about yourself in the first place.
And a message here saying, I'm a fast talker and stutter, so sometimes it affects me at work. I'm confident at the beginning, but when we go deep into a conversation, I lose the confidence. What can I do? I'm a fast talker as well, and I'm always writing notes saying, slow down, take a breath. But it can feel a bit forced sometimes. Any insights there?
I'm a fast talker too. So it's something I've really had to work on. And so it's really that it's about being mindful. Slow down. And if you think that you are speaking slowly, you're probably not. You're probably speaking at a normal pace. And the thing is with speaking slowly is when you speak slow, it actually calms you down and it relaxes you. If you're speaking very quickly, you feel more anxious, you feel more nervous. Mm-hmm. So speak slowly. And, you know, also before you go into that kind of conversation, for example, make sure that you go in with a clear mind. So do some breathing, practice mindfulness, and naturally that will slow down the pace.
Thank you so much. For anyone that does want a bit of coaching, what's the best way of reaching out to you, whether that is communication or confidence, and of course the podcast as well, how to contact you, Alia?
Yeah, so, you know, follow me on Instagram, coach_Alia. I share a lot of tips there as well. You can visit my website, aliaraja.com, or connect with me on LinkedIn. Those are the different ways. And yeah, have a listen to the podcast as well.
Thank you so, so much. Really, really useful. Really appreciate it.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We've been talking about the importance of great communication skills, and joining us on the line is Abraham Thomas. He has worked his way up in the finance industry, a seasoned public speaker, and he's there at ProTech in Abu Dhabi. Abraham, I've been a little bit overwhelmed by the number of messages we've had on this topic. Public speaking, good communication skills in the workplace. Clearly a very real concern for an awful lot of people. So we are going to revisit this topic in the future. But can you tell us about how improving and building on your communication skills has really helped you at work?
Wonderful. Thank you very much. I think that's a question that I think, you know, many people would love to have an answer on. And I would love to give you an answer from my own personal experience.
Please do.
Definitely, I could speak a little bit, but whether that was in any form organized or understandable to the others was something that I'm not certainly sure about. But having improved my communication skills, one thing that I did realize is that it gave me an extremely important byproduct of being able to communicate with people better, and that byproduct was confidence.
Mm-hmm. I think that's often a bit of a missing piece, and for so many people we've heard from this afternoon, it is exactly that. It's building the confidence. And can you give us a couple of quick tips or techniques that you've used to build that confidence, which has then, of course, become an essential building block of your workplace presence?
Right. I'll tell you how it's helped me quickly at workplace. Better communication skills allowed me to come through to board meetings, budget meetings, where, you know, there's a constant issue with other senior managers wanting their way versus how you like to project things or look at things. And being able to neutralize the antagonism that is there through good communication, where, you know, you're not giving it away, yet you are giving them the understanding that you're willing to look at things from their perspective also.
Mm-hmm.
We accountants are generally known to be very, you know, very boring people.
I would never say that.
You probably wouldn't, but you know, there's so many stories that go around, and I don't know whether you really have the time for it, but I'll share one with you. There was a lady who went to a doctor, and he diagnosed her with, a terminal illness. And she said, "What do I do, doctor?" And she said, "And I don't really think anything I can do to change the lifespan, but what I suggest you do is get married to an accountant, and your life will seemingly look and feel a lot longer."
That's how I feel about giving up sugar. I'm like, yeah, life's just going to seem an awful lot longer.
Yes, it's actually allowed me to become not just confident and be able to neutralize and negate some of the issues that are there with other people. And generally, overall, when you are communicating better, they tend to give you that much more leverage with what you're trying to put
across. More understanding. Abraham, we've run out of time, unfortunately, but thank you. It's really great to hear a personal side to a conversation. We will absolutely be continuing, and wishing you all the very best. And for the record, not boring at all. Abraham Thomas there. We are speaking now about quiet firing. Just last week, we were talking about quiet quitting, where employees are doing just the bare minimum, coasting, to keep their job. So the new term, quiet firing, according to experts across the globe, being quietly fired is actually more common. So talking us through it now is Sunika Aaron. She is the founder and managing partner of Marching Sheep. What a great name. An HR advisory firm that specialises in strategic HR advisory, diversity, inclusion interventions and capability building. Sunika, what exactly is quiet firing? Surely you know when it happens. How quiet can it be?
Thank you so much, Helen. Even though the term has been coined recently, it has been around for a very long time. When employers or managers create an environment where employees are not able to see, and I'm using my words very carefully, when they are not able to see work-life alignment, that is where quiet firing happens. Now, one might create as many policies, as many checks and balances, but if managers are operating from a mindset where they feel that an employee is not going to serve their purpose, they create an environment where they make an employee feel less valued. Mm-hmm. So, for example, not giving them enough responsibility, not making them feel important in team meetings, not giving them adequate pay raise, not giving them enough learning and growth opportunities. And that is when employees start to feel a lack of motivation, and that is quiet firing.
So it is not new.
Sorry.
So this, I'm just trying to kind of imagine what this would look like in practice, as you say. It's not necessarily being overt. It is these, and perhaps people don't even know they're doing it, but making an employee feel neglected, and yes. then perhaps that, you know, it leads to that sense of dread, that sense of not feeling fulfilled in the workplace, not feeling valued, not being, as you say, kind of learning development opportunities are non-existent. So someone starts to have these doubts of, well, why am I here? You know, where is this leading? And then they choose to leave themselves. So it's their kind of, is the employer then putting the onus on the employee to pull the trigger, so to speak? Or is it more of a decision from the employer side that this is going to be a final goodbye?
So this is kind of, creating an environment where the person will himself drop out or herself drop out. So to give you an example, you might have policies which say that we cannot terminate a woman who might be pregnant, or we might have policies that we have, working mothers. But if we do not give them the opportunity to take up stretch assignments that they might want, if we do not give them learning opportunities, if we do not give them the support that they might need to do their job, eventually they will look for other opportunities and move out.
Your confidence might be knocked. You might be searching for a job when you're not feeling valued and not feeling like someone who can contribute very well to the workplace. So it sounds like it could be really destructive. I'm presuming that HR can help with this in some shape or form. You know, what have you seen when it comes to HR managers, I guess, constructively handle situations like this?
So HR plays a very important role. And, Helen, earlier HR was seen as the go-to person for employees. But if you really see, how does an employee experience an organization? Who are they speaking to the most every day? They are speaking to their managers and their leaders and their peers. Mm-hmm. So the role of HR is to create a culture where managers and leaders are inclusive, and they are creating an environment which is psychologically safe, where everybody feels valued. So the role of HR today is to identify these issues and enable the managers to overcome their stereotypes, preconceived notions, and create a culture in the organization where everyone feels valued. Mm-hmm. So it is not just about having these conversations with people who might not be feeling valued, but also to enable managers and leaders to overcome their preconceived notions.
We've had previous discussions on HR, and it's something I think we should definitely revisit in the future. I think for many employees, they understand that HR works for the company and doesn't necessarily work for them. And I think that can feel like quite an unsafe environment for some people to think, well, you know, HR is being paid by this company, and how protected am I as an employee? How does the UAE provide a kind of safe environment through policies for growth and, you know, dismissal, you know, where the employee is front and center with their rights intact? Is there anything here that you think is worth highlighting?
So UAE has been doing a lot of things. If you look at a lot of laws which have been put in place. So, for example, in 2015, there have been anti-discriminatory laws. There are paternity acts. In 2018, there were equal wages. There is a term called people of determination. Having said that, HR plays a very important role where they need to balance between employees and the organization. They might be, working for the organization, but end of the day, an organization runs through employees. People are the one who are doing the job. So if you see, there are so many organizations like KPMG, there is this construction company called Al Nabuda, which is working on women development program. There are companies like Roche, which are focusing on creating safe spaces for people with disability. And all this is being done because HR has created a culture where happiness of employees, accommodation, safe working spaces is important. So I believe that HR can play a very important role by not just keeping the policies there, but enabling managers to implement those policies and practices mm-hmm. in letter and spirit. And that involves enabling managers to overcome the stereotypes and mindsets. That requires a learning framework to be put in place for managers and leaders. That is a role that HR needs to play in UAE.
Thank you so much. I'm so sorry, we have run out of time on the topic, but I really think it's an important one. I think we are going to be talking about unfair dismissals and any legal issues in the workplace with our legal expert after 4 o'clock. But thank you for highlighting this. And we've had a number of messages on the topic, Sneeka. Really do appreciate your insights. Sneeka Aaron, the founder and managing partner at Marching Sheep, and message here saying, silent firing. Worked in an organisation for 7 years. Manager comes to me one day and says, your position has been applied for by another person. You've got a month to transfer internally. So we will absolutely return to this topic.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is the time where the text lines tend to go a little bit bananas. Joining us live on the line is Ludmila Yamalova from HBL and Malavan Pluka. We're on Facebook Live as well. So if you've got any questions, get in touch. And you can do that in the comments, or of course, get in touch the usual way, 4001. Use that ARN Play app on the WhatsApp too. And you don't need to put your name on if you would prefer not to. Ludmila, thank you for joining us today. I've got lots of questions from listeners. I've got questions for you as well. But I just wanted to come back to a topic we were talking about earlier today, quiet firing, when a company makes a work environment actively unpleasant or demotivating in order to, well, hope for a resignation rather than having to pull the trigger themselves. And I wondered if you could explain what kind of policies are in place to protect employees in situations such as that, and to make sure that, you know, everybody's getting what is owed if this is the situation that arises. Can you elaborate for us?
Indeed. You know, one, it's an interesting, situation these days in light of the new labor law, because under the previous version of the labor law, there was a difference between being terminated and resigning. Although after 5 years of service, it didn't really make a difference. Under the new law, that difference is a lot less apparent. In other words, as long as the employment ends, whether the employee is being terminated or resigns voluntarily, the difference in benefits is actually quite marginal. In the past, in addition to, for example, losing out potential end of service benefits, there was at least, by some interpretation, a penalty for resigning early from a limited contract. So therefore, in addition to losing compensation, you would also have to pay a penalty. Mm-hmm. Under the current circumstances, it's not really the case. So whether you're terminated or you resign yourself, you basically walk away more or less with the same kinds of benefits. So it actually does not really serve employers much good these days to push the employees out by ultimately mistreating them. So it's a bit of a misnomer in what they're doing. And so from a legal front, they won't benefit. And I think from a practical front, it obviously is a counterproductive exercise, because if you're trying to make employees feel uncomfortable, it obviously will affect the morale of the remaining employees. And it certainly does not reflect positively on you as the employer.
Absolutely.
My stance as a professional, as a lawyer, and also as a business owner, is that if somebody does not work out, you just basically let them go and not have to torture themselves and yourself and the rest of your staff by just having someone that you ultimately don't want to see be part of your team.
So it
truly is a kind of a counterproductive exercise on all fronts, and I would hope that all those who are trying to do the sort of quiet firing are listening and taking note, and will make the right decision to end things properly and quickly without having to put everybody through this sort of torment.
Well said. And we didn't touch on that earlier, but as you say, company reputation is really key. If someone's miserable, that's going to spread pretty fast. And good luck at attracting some good talent if that's the way you work with your employees. Questions coming in as ever for Ludmila Yamalova. One here from Will saying, how can I report a driver who lets their small child, approximately 5 years old, sit in the front seat with no seatbelt? It's one of the parents from school, and I see it every day. Can I take a photo of his plate? And then what? Great question. Now we're back to school. I've seen, yeah, some questionable driving practices myself, Will. So what is the correct recourse here? Because I think a lot of people have a fear of taking that photo and then ultimately perhaps getting in trouble themselves. What does the law say?
A great question indeed, and there's a great solution, a recourse, as you said. There is a Dubai police app that allows you to do exactly that. So it allows you to record an incident and report the incident to the authority without having the repercussions or fear the repercussions of potentially filming or taking photos of someone without their consent. So as long as you do it through the Dubai police app, that is all legitimate evidence and legitimate type of reporting. Without having to fear the consequences. As I say that, though, be mindful that it does require ultimately filing a complaint with the Dubai police. So if you know the people well, those people who drive the child, even though illegally, just be mindful of the consequences that the police may come knocking on their door and you may, as the witness, be implicated as well. So as long as you're comfortable with that practical situation, legally, there is a great recourse there to report these kinds of incidents.
And a message here following up. So how can I report drivers who put their kids out the window? And how do I get in trouble for overusing the phone? I think that's a really good point, actually. You don't want to be, you know, driving and taking a photo at the same time and ultimately getting in trouble. So, you know.
And we have actually heard of cases exactly that. Someone was trying to do a good deed by reporting and try an incident. And ultimately, because they themselves were breaking the law in doing so, they too got into trouble. So you don't want to do that if you have a passenger in your car and then they could do the filming for you.
Thank you, Ludmila. Keeping Ludmila Umalova with us this afternoon, we've got questions about divorce here. We're going to be addressing that. Also about resigning staff, about landlord giving notice, and Harold asking, are boreholes legal? Our water bills are insane and our gardener is recommending we get one. Should you, Harold? We'll find out next.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live today, we've got Ludmila Umalova. It is your legal clinic. So do get in touch if there's anything that's on your mind, maybe you're seeking a bit of clarity on. You can do this anonymously, of course. We know sometimes when we're talking about personal law or indeed professional, it is an opportunity to make up a fake name. We completely understand. 4001 is your SMS. You've got your ARN Play app. And you've got the WhatsApp too, 0487155500. Great question here from Harold, Ludmila, saying, are boreholes legal? Our water bills are insane and our gardener is recommending we get one. Our gardener in our old house recommended one. And I can't remember why we didn't do it. It might have been the fact we found out the legality of it. So can you explain a little bit about, is it a go or is it a no?
Well, it depends on the setup. To be honest with you, there's nothing in the regulation specifically that addresses these kinds of questions. And we've had over the years many questions about people wanting to install their own AC units, for example, for the very same reason. And technically speaking, there's nothing in the regulations that makes it illegal. But ultimately, I think where it can come down to in terms of a breach of certain regulations is municipality, depending on the structure of these particular devices and how they might interfere or fit in into the rest of the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So on that front, there could be some potential issues, but it is a bit of a gray area. And if there are gardeners that are en masse are recommending the solution, I would like to think that these kinds of devices have been built and installed previously, and they've been at least implicitly certified or approved by the municipalities, because I mean, right now, for the time being, there's nothing expressly prohibiting about it. But you do need to be mindful of what it takes to build one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If anyone does have any more intel on this, let us know. We love hearing your insights and advice. No name on this message, and an upsetting message, Ludmila, saying, my wife, after learning that I filed for divorce, started provoking physical fights. Recently, she filed a complaint to the police with a medical certificate that I beat her. The police called me and told me this is for now a temporary complaint, but she was sent to Dubai Police Hospital for reassessment. What can I expect from a wrong accusation? Oh my goodness, it sounds incredibly stressful and upsetting and frustrating. If this is the case, Ludmila, where does this caller stand?
Well, if it is truly a wrongful accusation, I'm not suggesting otherwise, then you would hope that the authorities, through this investigation protocol, which the listener describes, that they would establish that this is a false accusation. Now, I mean, physical violence is can be proven, I guess, in multiple ways. One is by the visual footage or the video footage of when it's happening or recordings when it's happening, and ultimately also a physical examination of the resulting wounds and the timing of it as well. So if all of these pieces kind of line up together, then obviously that's a potential evidence, or it could be even circumstantial evidence that you just need to prepare to rebut. But if it's all falsely made up, and then that too should be fairly easy to establish. So don't be afraid. I mean, if these accusations are false, don't be afraid to go to the police and to give your testimony, to give your reporting, to perhaps provide your own side of evidence, be it other kinds of reportings or witnesses or video footage or audio. So don't be afraid of it, because if it didn't happen, it should be fairly easy mm-hmm. to prove it. The burden of proof is on her to prove that actually, not that it just happened, but that you were the one who caused it. So that's on that side. Now, moving forward, what I recommend, and I know this is very difficult, easier said than done, but if, and we have seen parties resort to these kinds of unfortunate techniques and tactics, then try to extricate yourself from that situation for the time being. And that is perhaps rent yourself a temporary place or hotel room and just try for the time being to just be physically separated from her so as to avoid these kinds of allegations, because obviously in that case it would be a lot easier to disprove mm-hmm. that anything like that would have happened if you're not living under the same roof. Mm-hmm. I'd say try to be very calm and keep your distance. Unfortunately, when these kinds of decisions happen in personal lives, people do become very emotional and do things that maybe in retrospect we hope that they regret. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, we all have to deal with the consequence. So I'd say just try to extricate yourself from unintentionally becoming a victim.
Thank you so much. We're keeping Ludmilla with us through until the end of the show today. So do get in touch if there's anything that you need some assistance on. Maybe it is an expert second opinion. Maybe it's not really sure knowing where to turn. And if your issue requires some one-on-one legal advice, test the waters here. It is your free legal clinic, an amazing opportunity. And as I said, always a busy one. So the sooner the better. Interestingly, up next, we're going to be tackling this question. And we normally hear it from the other side. No name, saying, I borrowed some money from a friend and said in a message to him I'd pay him back after 2 months. I've not been able to, and now they're threatening legal action. Can they sue me?
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Ludmilla Yamalova joining us this afternoon to look behind the headlines, unpick laws that you need some clarity on, and of course take your questions too. Ludmilla, in light of some headlines, I wanted to really get a bit of clarity on what we need to know here in the UAE about inappropriate online content that are against the public morals of the UAE. What are some of the platforms that we need to be aware of? What about reporting and consequences as well?
Well, you use a very important phrase, and that is public morals. And that ultimately is the all-encompassing test, if you will, for any kind of content or actions or behavior that we may want to engage in this country. So there is this kind of an overarching rule that anything that is against the country's public moral is illegal. Now, it's illegal not just on the civil front, but it's illegal on the criminal front. So there are at least two laws that are implicated in this particular case. So if it's anything that is any kind of inappropriate content, inappropriate, it's a very broadly defined phrase, and that is inappropriate would be anything that is ultimately against public morals. It could be something that's inappropriate, for example, that's against, that violates somebody's breach of privacy. That's a specific provision in the law. If somebody that insults someone, that's yet another specific provision in the law. Someone that, for example, threatens to blackmail someone, that's another provision in the law. But then there is also, in addition to all these specific laws, there's this kind of blanket or a catch-all. Anything that's against public morals is also against the law. And so now there are two types of, if you will, categories of some inappropriate actions that could get individuals or companies, for that matter, in trouble. One is that any kind of inappropriate content, i.e. content that's against public morals, that's transmitted through digital means, anything related to that kind of communication or behavior is subject to the UAE cybercrime law, and that cybercrime law does actually carry criminal sanctions and then penalties. And the penalties are quite severe, and they're severe for that very reason, that the reach and the scope and the potential damage of committing any kind of crimes or inappropriate comments through the digital and cyber lines, obviously, is a lot broader and bigger, and they're therefore more serious. And that's why the penalties are a lot more serious. And then there's that kind of content or actions that happen in the physical world. So, for example, you do something, you say something face-to-face, or you do an action or an act that is in the physical world that does not involve communication through the cyber lines, then that is subject to the UAE crime and punishment law. So these are the two sources of law. One is the UAE crime and punishment law, and the other one is the cybercrime law. And both of them ultimately are criminal, have or carry criminal penalties in nature, and therefore, depending on the extent and the nature of the incident, be it meaning the language, for example, the extent of the action, it could lead to just a fine, and the fine could be anything from 1,000 dirhams to 500,000 dirhams to 1,000,000 dirhams, and also to a fine plus imprisonment and plus deportation. So it really depends on the extent of the inappropriate content. But what I would like, for the parting words I would like to share, is that we're still in the UAE, and it is, and we must know and be respectful and aware that this country does have its own religious, cultural, and moral fabric, and it expects all of us who are guests here and also citizens to just be mindful of that, and whatever we communicate should be communicated with that filter in mind, and that is just be mindful and not to do anything that potentially may be against public morals, or at least not publicly or in a way that could jeopardize your all the benefits that we enjoy here, living here. So well, it's said. You know, it's in, but to be honest with you, it's actually not a, it's an interesting system, because in other countries, and we've recently seen a whole flurry of cases in, for example, the U.S. and other countries, where celebrities are now complaining and file lawsuits because somebody was at a wedding taking photos of them, and that was supposed to be a private wedding, and now that the footage is out there, it's sort of, it's not just damage control. You almost cannot unwind that kind of
the reputational damage. The toothpaste is out of the tube, as I always say to my children. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. All right, Ludmilla, quick fire round on the questions. As I said, you can give us a call, you can message us. And we've got a question here on the phone line from Ricky.
I've got a staff who has just finished 18 months with the company, and he has given a resignation without any notice. He wants to leave immediately. He wants to go back. So does he lose all his benefits for 18 months or 20 months he's completed? And also, do I need to pay for his airfare ticket to repatriate him back to his home country? Thanks.
Great question, Ricky. So 18 months, 20 months served. Where does Ricky, as the employer, stand on gratuity and repatriation?
So if the employee resigns or is even being terminated with notice, so the one, I guess the one requirement is notice period.
Absolutely.
So if the employee resigned, then the employee is required to serve the notice period. The minimum notice period by law is 1 month unless contractually agreed to a longer notice period. However, the employee can compensate the company for the duration of the notice if he or she cannot serve it. So the company can't force the employee to serve the notice, but they, but the employee can offer a compensation in lieu of serving the notice. Now, that's basically really the only requirement, and therefore, if you will, a penalty. Because if the employee resigns, even if it's after 18 months, the company is still required to pay end-of-service benefits. This is the departure from the previous version of the law, which is if you, in the past, if you had limited contract, in particular, if you resigned early, you would lose out your end of service. Now you do not. So really the only penalty for the employee, if you want to call it that, and the only expectation for the company is that that notice period, and other than that, all the other benefits remain, that is end of service, unpaid vacation, and any other unpaid salaries, obviously, and also repatriation. So if the employee is leaving the country, then yes, the company is still required to pay repatriation expenses, i.e. the ticket home.
Thank you for that, Ricky. Really hope that helps you navigate this employee's exit. Anonymous question, and we do tend to get this message, but on the flip side. So a message saying, I borrowed some money from a friend and said in a message to him I'd pay him back after 2 months. I've not been able to, and now they're threatening legal action. Can they sue me? We often get people saying, I've lent money and I can't get it back. What do I do? So in this situation, what is possible and yes. what should you do?
Certainly. One is absolutely they can sue you. I mean, anybody at any point in time can file a case against any one of us. It's just more about whether they can prevail. In this particular case, not only can they sue you or sue the listener, but also they can legitimately expect a more or less favorable verdict in light of the little that we know about the facts that the listener just shared with us, and that is the confirmation of debt. Mm-hmm. So there is an administrative tool in the UAE legal jurisprudence, which is called the payment order, and that is if there's evidence of a confirmed debt, then it is possible to file this extra expedited court request, and then it's an administrative request, not a substantive one. Now, on the back of which the court can issue a judgment, or should issue a judgment in just 1 or 2 days. That's basically by law. They're required to examine and decide these kinds of administrative matters in that time span. And so then basically, it's unless it's challenged, it can become an enforceable action quite quickly. So they can, and they legally, they have good chances of succeeding, even if all they have is evidence of WhatsApp correspondence from you saying, yes, I borrowed X amount, and yes, I will pay it back to you. That would ultimately satisfy the evidence of a confirmed debt. What you should do in the meantime, I'd say just negotiate now, knowing what you know. I think you should take this seriously and negotiate with them, because obviously they would not necessarily want to file a case just because that in itself is a hassle and there could be some additional expense. Mm-hmm. So my recommendation is just negotiate and figure out a payment plan that you can practically repay.
Thank you so much for that. I think it is really useful for anyone that feels like they're feeling trapped or there's no way out. There's always something you can do. There is recourse, and all the very best. Let's see if we can squeeze in one last question. This is from Mariam saying, what does the law say on the below? We're the owners of a residential villa, but in order to add areas like balcony or garden in the house, we're required to pay fees to the builder. We thought the land is ours to do what we want once we buy it. But if you don't have permission from the builder, so I think the developer in this case, there's a fine. Any advice, please? Oh, I've had friends having to repaint their homes because they haven't been in the approved lookbook of developers here. So I can well imagine balcony gardens need to be adhering to certain rules. Ludmilla, what have you heard in the past?
Yes, so there's a bit of a juxtaposition here. There's the law, the underlying law, which is a freehold. It's called the property ownership or freehold law. And freehold law, by definition, allows you to hold the property and do with it whatever you want to do. So that's the listener is coming from that perspective, and that's how it is in many other countries. In this country, but also to an extent in other countries, that in addition to that law, there's specific regulations in each community that particular property could be subject to. So it's not so much subject to a specific law, but rather regulations or common property rules that apply to that particular project, and therefore all the villas or condos or condominiums inside it. And they will spell out, for example, what they can do and cannot do without, and what requires approval. So, most of the time, according to those regulations, you know, most communities that I've seen, there's always a kind of a protocol in terms of what you can do if you want to, for example, do any kind of structural changes to your property. So if it's just repainting your interior, you don't really need to do very much, though in some cases the community may actually require approvals for those contractors to come in into the community, and that in itself can carry a cost as well. So that does exist in this country, and you just need to be mindful that whenever you move in addition to a kind of understanding that, yes, okay, you're buying this freehold, what the community rules are, because every community should have rules and has rules, and you should have a copy of those rules when you buy so that you know and how to manage your expectations in the long run.
No pink or rainbow houses. You need to be aware. Let's squeeze in one last. This is from Pete saying, my wife is insisting that we should have a legal document that states who would get our children should something ever happen. Do we need to go through a lawyer for this? Great question, Pete, which is why I think I've managed to find a bit of time. Milani's have to do a very short traffic. Tell us, Ludmilla.
Indeed. So if they're not Muslim, there is a great mechanism and it does not require involvement of a lawyer. And that is through the DIFC Wills Center and Wills and Probate Center. And that there is actually a standard form on the DIFC for guardianship. So you can just download the form and just pay the DFC fees only. And they already have a template for just, you know, that provides only for guardianship of minor children. So that does not at all require lawyers. There's a template. You can just fill in the details of your children and your own details and then submit to the DFC and just pay the DFC fees only, not the legal fees. Mm-hmm. But there is still a cost to the DFC center.
Okay, thank you, Ludmilla. Really, really helpful as ever. We have had a few questions we couldn't get to today, but don't forget, you can, of course, contact Ludmilla direct. She's there at HPL in Malvern Pluka. Well worth a follow across social media as well, really breaking down some headlines and offering some really accessible information, plus, of course, the opportunity to connect with her at Ludmilla Umalova. Ludmilla, we'll catch up with you next week, wishing you a great week ahead. Thank you again, as ever. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.